I fully realize that the subject this morning is not very enticing in the program, but I think there are some important points to be made. Perhaps to restore our recognition of some of the simple truths that we are all overlooking every day. Homer, in writing the story of the Odyssey, mentions that the gods of Greece and Troy fought in the heavens above the city. And Troy, incidentally, was completely destroyed over a family feud. An instance of this is of my point of view. Troy was located in what is now Asia Minor, in the site of another war, and a series of wars, most of which have no more basis in existing facts than the war at Troy. And in both cases, ancient and modern, the gods are called upon to fight for their respective sides, and no one seems to pay any attention to the fact that when the gods fight each other, one of their own teams has to lose, all of which is part of our general tendency to ignore the facts of life. The simplest fact we know about life is that we're all together here on a little ball in space about 8,000 miles in diameter, going at a great speed in space with a small layer of atmosphere around it, and outside of that a vacuum where nothing that we know here can exist. This has been going on for quite a long while, and this has become quite an important home site for peoples growing on this planet. Now, the planet itself is a mixed blessing in many ways, but essentially important. The planet is composed of various materials, and the surface is divided into land, water, and ice areas. Of the surface of the Earth, probably the largest single element is water. In the midst of the water, there arise continents. And at the north and south pole, there are great banks of ice and glacier that never melt. Now, in this peculiar atmosphere, in this environment, humanity began. Or at least it was isolated here, as though shipwrecked in space. Here we have, on this planet now, approximately 6 billion people. These human beings are all of them limited by this particular environment. We are all shipwrecked together on a relatively small planet. And at the same time, even with this realization, we can't seem to get along together. There seems to be no advantage in separating because there's no place to go but out. And if we go out, that is the end. We talk about the possibility of habiting other planets, but at the moment there doesn't seem to be much real estate selling out there. We are here, living together. At the time of the siege of Troy, there were less than 200 million people on the earth. Today, it is becoming crowded. Those people had no worry about traffic jams. They had no difficulty in harvesting. There was no probability of shortages of essential resources. But these people lived in a planet which was sparsely populated, even as late as the Middle Ages. And yet these people began the process of disliking each other. And way back in the first days of recorded and allegorical history, wars, small and large. One author covering the whole subject came to the conclusion that in the course of our history, humanity has fought nearly 10,000 wars, big ones and little ones and backyard fights. All of these contentions on a little planet hurtling through space. If the law of gravity failed for 5 minutes, that'd be the end of humanity. We live here because of the wonderful interaction of universal laws, and beneath the surface of our planet is a tremendous wealth of essential resource material. And here we sit, going on as we always have gone on, fighting our way for territorial sovereignty. We know the animal kingdom makes a great deal of having its proper territorial rights. Today, territorial rights constitute almost anything we can get our hands on. But the idea of territorial right as a means of survival has become gradually modified because we are now one people on the planet, even though we can't get along together. So we have today a problem, a very serious problem. And we can go back to consider some of the things that have happened. Mao, the Chinese communist, made a rather pertinent remark some years ago. He said the Chinese invented writing and printing, and they did it with movable type, but they never printed a newspaper. They'd invented gunpowder and all kinds of fireworks, but they used them only for weddings, funerals, and celebrations, never for war. So there were two things. The third one he mentioned is the mariner's compass, which the Chinese also invented, but they were very careful not to use it for the discovery of the Western Hemisphere. So we have, going all the way back, Mao probably has forgotten one of the great wars of China. He forgot the war that was fought probably in the 3rd or 4th century A.D., in which the battlefront was 100 miles long. They have been excavating the bones and the weapons for years. From very early times, there was mostly strife. And this strife was essentially useless, worthless, and meaningless. Alexander the Great conquered nearly half of India and died under the walls of Babylon, looking for further worlds to conquer. But he never conquered himself, and that was the end of it. This Roman conquest, we all know from history, it was the death of one of the great Egyptian pharaohs that brought Akhenaten to the throne of Egypt and made him the first pacifist in history. His reward was to be murdered. All these things happened. Caesar died at the foot of Pompey's statue with a knife of his best friend in his heart. Always the same tragedies repeat themselves. Always the same dilemmas exist. Always the same ambitions go on, producing nothing but darkness and death while this little ball floats through space. It's all very ridiculous. Also, we go a little further into the imports of history to find out some of the things that happened. Consider the Crusades. Four waves of effort of the most powerful leaders of European life to reconquer the Holy Land. A dismal failure. Never was accomplished. And millions of people on both sides died or impoverished, wounded, or left desolate. This was one of the big experiences. Another one which we must also bear in mind is, of course, the Crusades first, and after that, the murder and abolition of the Knights Templars. The most powerful order of chivalry that opened the roads to Jerusalem was decimated, destroyed, and its leaders burned at the stake. Everywhere, the same struggle went on. In France, the Huguenots. And in Japan, two efforts of the Khans of Mongolia to conquer the country. The first time they sent a great fleet against Japan, and the same thing happened that happened with the Spanish Armada in the English Channel. A great storm arose and destroyed the Chinese fleet, so that the Japanese were spared. But the fear of it all was real and definite, and later Kublai Khan tried it again. This time, however, the Japanese were ready for him. But out of this came a very sad circumstance. To defend the coastline of Japan, the Japanese created a militant order, which they now know and we now know as the samurai. These defended the country, but when there was nothing more to defend on the outside, they turned in and began to dominate the local and natural peacefulness of the Japanese people. Out of that came one rebellion after another, one conflict after another, to the final establishment of the Tokugawa shogunate. We look in among the what happened in the Western Hemisphere. We realize what Cortez did to Mexico. When he came here, his first report to the Spanish crown was that the city of Mexico was the most beautiful city in the world, with magnificent buildings, marvelous pathways and roads, and beautiful lagoons running through the city. In a very few years, he left it a total ruin. We go further south into the Maya area, and we find Montejo and the ruin of a completely civilized people of which nothing but ruin was left. Then we go to Pizarro in Peru, and we find he obliterated the civilization of the Inca. And when someone asked the Inca chief what they did with criminals in that Inca state, he replied, "I don't know, we never had any." But in a short time, in the effort to find the secret hidden treasures of the Incas, a complete civilization was destroyed. The highest civilizations probably of their time, in Mexico, Yucatan, and South America, were all destroyed by greed. So we have all this type of thing. We come on down through the Napoleonic Wars. We find all of these, and then we come down to the modern times. Two world wars in the present century, after nearly 10,000 years of tradition and history, we are unable to cope with the problems of human relationship in the 20th century without causing the two greatest wars the world has known for 1,000 years. What's the matter? This is really a problem. There has to be an answer to this, because this little ball flowing through space, it can't go on this way forever. We are not only concerned now with the little ball and its peoples, but we find out that people begin to believe that this ball is something they own. We find people buying and selling this ball, admit parts of it as they can get hold of. They have an idea that this earth was created for the purpose of enriching human selfishness. And we've been building on that thought for a long time, but there isn't much truth in it. We have never recognized the fact that natural resources belong to nature, that we are part of a great moral structure, which we totally disregard. And as a result of that, we're in trouble all the time, and have been ever since we started out. Now come the gods that fought over Troy. At this time, and always in the past, religion, unfortunately, has played a powerful part in the antagonisms of mankind. It was religion that caused the Inquisition. It was religion that resulted in one catastrophe after another, including the Trojan War. It was religion always in which, in the name of God, individuals kill each other. Now, why is this true? It is because we have as yet no real working concept of God. We have a whole series of theological definitions. We know that there are 72 names of him recorded in the Shem HaMefaresh of the Kabbalah, but we have never found the mystery of the one God. We have never found a God whom we could all gather and revere. It's been divided into sectarianisms and various religious revelations, which are, for the most part, difficult to bring together. We have a fighting now in the Near East and in many parts of the world. We have Christian, Jew, and Muslim fighting in a land which is governed by an ancient code that says, "Thou shalt not kill." But this is ignored. It is always right to kill anybody who doesn't believe as you do. This has been the story of religion since the beginning. Therefore, we find that religion has motivated probably most of the great wars of history. Religion has motivated so that all of them, in one way or another, were holy wars. Napoleon was convinced that God had ordained him to unite Europe. One group after another, under political or religious terms, has gone on a crusade to end all war by exterminating the human race. So here we are now with another problem coming up very closely. We are now working also beneath the surface of this little planet that is floating through space. We are gradually exhausting its natural resources. We cannot go on taking petroleum out forever, for this little bottle, which we call a planet, has limited capacity. We are now withdrawing from the Earth resources that were millions of years in the making, and we are putting nothing back except refuse. We have done nothing to protect the survival of the future. We live only now for the future to take care of itself. This is beginning to catch up with us. And on every hand today, there is a great dissension. And most of this dissension is against selfishness. It is against the effort to monopolize on the natural resources of the planet. And these resources have to be conserved, or we're going to be in a very serious way, possibly before the end of the present generation. So to accomplish all these things, we're going to have to begin to think a little differently. We're going to have to realize that in this world of ours, nobody owns anything. This is a difficult thing to believe because we've been borrowing money on what we didn't own for ages. But in sober fact, all that we have belongs to space. All of it belongs to this mysterious and wonderful unity, which we call life. It belongs to the mystery of the solar systems and the cosmic systems and the great chains of worlds. We do not own the planet. We cannot buy it, we cannot sell it, we cannot keep it. No matter how hard we conquer it, we are going to die and somebody else is going to get it. There is no way of having the kind of ownership that we think. Therefore, what we term wealth is an illusion. As long as wealth is concerned with physical possessions, we are getting rich off of something we don't own. We are spending the principal as well as the interest. There is nothing in the physical world that we actually own. We don't even own our own bodies. We are here as part of a great plan. We are here to grow and to use the facilities of nature to become better. We have never seemingly recognized our moral responsibility to the plan to which we belong. And the time has come when more thought must be directed in that position and that relation. We are not the owners of the earth. We are not the owners of our brothers. We cannot enslave anybody successfully. And we at the same time cannot gain peace, happiness, or security for ourselves alone. Each group fighting itself is like the jungle with the territorial domain given to a tiger or a lion. We have here now one humanity. There's nothing we can do about this but recognize it. We realize this one humanity is not a magnificent, massive structure. It is something existing on one of the humblest and most unimportant of the planets in the solar system. We are here because of the need for growth, for the need to build something, to fulfill a purpose, so that each of us, as we go out of incarnation, take something with us we didn't have when we came. And the things we take with us can never be material accomplishments. We are here definitely to correct selfishness and to outgrow the concept of eternal segregations and also the ultimate sovereignty of this planet by one political or religious unit. There is only one religion big enough for the planet, and that is the religion that is made up of all religions. We have now a very strong religious majority in this planet. This majority is all bound by oath and obligation to rules or convictions that are essentially benevolent. We have in all, probably out of our 6 billion, we probably have 4.5 billion moderately associated with religion. These constitute many different faiths, but they represent in every case a pronouncement of the golden rule. Many years ago when I visited Jerusalem, there was on the Mount of Olives a little chapel that may not even be there anymore. And on the walls were the golden rule in all different languages. That you do unto others as we would have others do unto us. Now, there's practically no religion that does not accept this, but does not live it. We continue to be competitive in our ethics in disseminating a doctrine that is cooperative. We are constantly trying to take people out of one faith and put them into another. We are perfectly willing to destroy a non-believer, and this is happening every day in the Near East now. We are not separated by our humanity, but by our inhumanity. We are not separated by the color of our skins or by our languages. We are separated by the belief that there are better and worse creatures in this world, when in reality there are only those of varying degrees of deprivation. So we have to begin to think rather seriously now of getting over some of this. This idea of the gods fighting over the city walls is now strong right here on our planet. It is now being divided up into two groups. Probably the most powerful groups that we have are the Muslim groups today. And even the Muslims are not united. The Muslims are divided into several different groups with very little in common except the Quran, which nearly all of them generally disregard. They disregard it because it interferes with the temporal ambitions of people. Out of every country there has risen dictators, dominant personalities, the Hitlers, the Mussolinis, the Napoleons. These people have all of them used humanity as a weapon against their enemy. They have built the idea that their way would sometime run the world. And in every case, their way has not run the world, and they have departed into silence with the mistakes that they made. So we have to outgrow this. We're getting very close to the time when we'll either have to begin to find common ground, or there won't be any common ground left for us to find. We're going to have to conserve resources. We're going to have to get over the petty differences with which we have cursed ourselves for so long. Religion is important, very important. But religion must be interpreted in terms of idealism and not in terms of material conquest. We are not here to convert each other. We are here to live constructive lives and help each other, regardless of race, beliefs, or any other dividing artificial factor. We are here to learn companionship, brotherhood, fraternity, and to unite to protect this little ball floating in space from being disintegrated by the very people that live on it. We are here to make certain that this little world becomes once more the garden that it was in the beginning. It was a beautiful place with everything that was necessary for happiness and security. In it we had the privilege of eminent domain for a time. We all came and went, as Omar tells us in the Rubaiyat. But there could be and was a very beautiful world. And according to some beliefs, at least, in this beautiful world, people lived a very long time. They didn't measure their lives in 70s or 80s or 90s. They measured their lives in centuries because they were peaceful, living off of natural means and natural ways. They loved each other, served each other, worked together, and to all these things, much was added to them. Competition is not only a destroyer of empire, it is a destroyer of physical health, mental health, and emotional health. The great struggle to dominate each other is more or less ridiculous when we realize what we dominate. We dominate nothing. 2 minutes of a minor tilt in the Earth's axis, and there's nothing for us to dominate, including ourselves. We are here not to dominate each other, but to prove that there is some way in which we can outgrow the deficits of human nature. Now, why should we be here in the first place? Is there any particular reason why 6 billion people should be on this little ball in space? I think possibly the ancients had as good an answer to that as we're ever going to have. This little house, this planet, is the anteroom. It is the pronaos of the temple of eternity. It is the entrance to the everlasting. We are here to grow and become worthy of citizenship in a larger world. We are not here to try to make this the great planet and cover it with monuments standing over the graves of the dead. We are here to learn this is a school, not a place of permanent residence. And the trouble is now with us is we're not graduating anybody. We keep on having the school, and we go over the same lessons time and time again, and when the time comes for examination, most of the examinations end in failure. We are here to learn and not to possess. We are here to work together and not to hate each other. We are here to grow up and fulfill the needs of human society and not try to divide it up and underprivilege the majority part of it. We are here simply to be simple human beings with kindly good intentions, with friendliness, with the recognition that it is up to us to help to conserve the neighborhood. That we are here to work together and not to work each other. We are here not to accumulate, but to become. What we have, we cannot take with us, only what we grow. And what we grow in this case is within ourselves. It is character, integrity, realization of values. Now, what does the gods have to do with this? Are they really on one side of something or on the other side of something else? Do we gain the favor of God by being converted to a belief? In the presence of maybe 10 or 12 fairly major religious beliefs on this planet, there has never been a really happy understanding that there is and can be only one religion. The one religion is in that it must be based upon the conduct of human beings, the ennoblement of humanity, and the dedication of all effort to the service of all need. Religion begins in service. It begins in the individual contributing to something that is not perishable. It is not by building bigger churches, but by building better people that the ends of religion are accomplished. We are here definitely, first of all now, to get over all sectarian religious division. This doesn't mean that we have to condemn anyone. It doesn't mean that we have to convert one individual to another. It doesn't mean that we have to create one religion and demand that all the others follow it. It is simply that we recognize in our hearts that all essential beliefs are the same. Therefore, that we can mingle in absolute equality with all who are trying to live the right kind of life. There is no need of changing the church. There's only need of changing the attitudes of people to the church and to get them away from these selfish situations which also finally taint the church itself. So we have got to work to get our religion so that no longer will the gods fight in heaven above the earth. They never did, but it was a good excuse. No one ever knows what the real answer to that might have been. But I think Homer hints at it when he points out that the final answer is the creation of the world hero. The Greeks recognized a race of beings called heroes. They were not gods and they were not mortals, but they were the immortal mortals. They were the link between heaven and earth. And these heroes were those who awakened the inner resources of themselves and became the spiritual guardians and guides of humanity. They are the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas of Asia. They are the saints and sages of the West. They represent a maturing of people until there comes a time when each individual, in his own way and in his own cycle of life, dedicates his efforts, his resources, and himself to the common service of all the others. There's got to be a final establishment of brotherhood, a final establishment of the recognition that we can make this little sojourn here much happier than it has been in the past. There is a distinct and definite relationship between human health and the world health. There is a definite relationship between the conflicts in society and the psychotic pressures within the individual himself. Our ambitions are killing us. Our various feuds and fusses are destroying us not only with weapons, but with the destruction of the resources of our own health and body. We are destroying our own minds. We are destroying our own bodies. And the only answer we can find for it is the common statement is we are having fun. We are not having fun. There is no fun in a world in which the average person cannot live a decent life. And we have come so far and learned so much and had so many great teachers who knew at least parts of the truth that there seems to be no reason why we should be fighting now on the same level as the Trojan War. There is no reason why we should repeat the Inquisition. There is no reason why we should go through again the same tyrannies that disfigured the past. We had religious revolutions, political revolutions, and social revolutions from the beginning. We have them again, but they are more bitter, more extravagant, wasting more essential resources than ever before. It wasn't so bad when they fought it out by throwing rocks at each other, because you could save the rocks and use them for something else afterwards. But the way it is now, we are exhausting all the resources of the earth in order to defeat each other without realizing that by so doing, we are digging the earth out from under all of us. We are getting into deeper and deeper difficulties every single day. The problem then comes right down to finding out what will do some good. Actually, we can't control other people. We can't prove to another person that he's wrong. We can try, and usually we will be thoroughly whipped for doing it. But we can begin to, in various ways, reach into our inner resources, and even if the ulterior motive persists, we can say to ourselves, I'd rather be healthy than sick. I'd rather be happy than unhappy. I'd rather be energetic than tired. And the world I'm living in is making me sick, making me tired, and making everybody unhappy. Therefore, the problem we have to figure in terms of policy, in terms of governments, is to find the common denominators where we can take this strain off ourselves and end it forever. We do not need to have these great struggles over government. We do not need to have millions of dollars spent trying to elect somebody to something. These things do not do the work for the reason that whoever is elected, the same thing happens. It all goes on because the individual and the community spirit is not strong enough to defend integrities. We are still hoping for a little profit. We are still sacrificing honor for possession or for luxury. We do not need to go through all these struggles and problems. And there is a coming of greater and greater intensity of determination to change some of these matters. We are finding it everywhere. Groups are springing up everywhere to correct common problems. We are beginning to wake up to the simple facts of life. And it's a very important thing that we continue to awaken and not be lulled back into sleep by something. We are very definitely on the verge of important decisions, but they will only be made correctly if we are unselfish. While the last thought is what we're going to get out of it, then there will be no correction. We have got to work together to change the basic pattern of this little molehill, as what Mark Twain called the planet Earth, is not going to be able to survive either. We do not know what happens inside the Earth. We do not know the psychic and electronic processes within the planet. We do not know what is under there. But we know there's something under there, because that something is protecting, guiding, and nourishing everything on the Earth. And without any thought of any kind, we're digging it all out if we can. We don't know what we're doing even, and are too set in our material ambitions to even try to find out. There is no question of trying to examine the Earth as possibly a great patient suffering from a serious malnutrition, a patient who has been exploited, a planet which has had so many transfusions taken out of it that there's not very much planet left, less all the time. And yet we continue to go on to take the last barrel of oil. And what do we use it for? Largely blow it up more. So we're using the lifeblood of a planet to hate each other. We're using it to waste. We're using it to become richer and more sedate individuals and with high transportational facilities. We are not even giving a thought to the planet. And yet it's all we have. There is nothing else. If that slips out from under us, it's gone. There's no place to land. We tried to take a journey over to see how the moon would be, but it wasn't very hopeful. It too is dead. How it died, we won't try to figure out. But we now have a situation where for the first time we've got to take a hard, long look at the natural resources which we depend upon. The only renewable element that we have found at the present time is wood. Outside of that, nearly everything can ultimately be expended. Stone, of course, can fall back to become stone again. But most of the things we're taking out of the earth, chemical, material things, all kinds of fuels, all kinds of minerals, mineral wealth, we don't know what we're taking out when we cannot take out another mass of diamonds or jade. We don't know what these things are. We don't know why they're there. We don't know how they got there. But there's just the point to think about that they were there for a reason, and not simply to satisfy the cupidity of some earthly businessman. We have a planet to take care of, and it's showing signs of sickness. There are modifications of climate that are very peculiar. There are modifications in our atmosphere. We are loaded with smog and chemicals. We keep right on. The smog, no one says you can't do anything about it. That's all right. You can do something about it, but people apparently have no intentions of doing anything seriously about it. There's great talk, and there's some controls, and then the next time the weather is bad, we have it all over again. There has to be a union now also to protect the globe we live on. We have to consider the planet as the greatest piece of real estate that we have, and the only piece. And we also have to realize that this piece of real estate belongs to the universe finally and entirely, and not to us. We are merely servants, stewards in a garden. We are here to protect resources or to create the bad karma of abusing resources. The individual who misuses the natural resources of life is earning punishment somewhere. Now we also realize that this world is made up of people who come and go. We realize also, in some cases, by the belief in reincarnation, that those who go may come back. If they don't believe this is true, then there must be more new ones coming in all the time. At least this planet is being handed down from one generation to another. And each generation gets a poorer bargain. Each generation has the opportunity to pay more for less. But this is the problem. What are we gaining out of it? I think the answer that we have to take from that is only one thing possible, and that is experience. The only thing we can take with us is what we learn and what we become by our own integrities. What we can take with us has nothing to do with any physical problem. And because we cannot take anything with us, the whole theory of accumulation is very badly undercut. We have no particularly good thing to do with what we do have, especially on the level of accumulation. We can leave it to our children, but that may be another disaster. We are not knowing what to do to make life interesting except by accumulating. And accumulating is gambling, and gambling is a process of taking from Peter to please Paul. One of these times, we're going to realize that this kind of fun is too dangerous. So we have a planet, and we have people. We have new epidemics. We have all kinds of health problems springing up. We have all kinds of moral and ethical problems springing up. All of them dependent largely upon the individual dominating his own life with his own selfishness. We want to do what we want to do, regardless of whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. But actually, the universe can win that fight over all of us. We can do what we want to do for a certain time, and then we have to pay. There is no avoiding that pay. And sometimes it comes much sooner than we expect. Instead of being something that happens 10 generations from now, it may be on our own doorstep. There is no question about the fact that man is morally responsible for the material uses he makes of his material environment. He is responsible for turning the world over to his own descendants in as good a condition as when it came to him. He has no right to create a bankruptcy for himself and then hand eternal debt onto his children. He has no right to make the world unlivable for the generations that have to come. And if he does this type of thing, there is a punishment. Now, the materialist believes that there's nothing but extinction beyond the present life. Even so, this does not remove the factor of punishment. Many of those who are delinquent are punished here and now. They do not have to wait for any future. But if we want to build a better life for ourselves, I think we take more or less the view of the Oriental, namely that there is a re-embodiment in the environment, and if we wreck it, we come back to it. That should put a little fear in our hearts, but that's too abstract. So we have a peculiar fallacy that is now working through us tremendously, and that is the fallacy of do it now. We have lost faith in the future. We do not believe in futures anymore. We say to ourselves, eat, sleep, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die. We have lost hope as far as building together for a great purpose. This loss of hope is simply an illusion. This loss of hope is a lie with which we try to fortify our own lack of discipline and our own willingness to curb our own selfishness. There is no reason why we must turn a bankrupt universe back to God. There is no reason why we should not make something out of it. Now, in the philosophies that we more or less recognize as good, there is a very interesting concept about this type of thing, this business of returning what we have borrowed. They have the story of the sowing and the reaping. We have the story of bringing the first fruits to the altars of the Lord. So we have now an idea that this life we live is a probationship, something for which we should be grateful for opportunity, the privilege of becoming friends, not the privilege of making enemies. we have the privilege of doing it right instead of the power to do it wrong. We have everywhere the inducements to build a better world, but we don't pay much attention to these inducements because we think that other people rather than ourselves are going to benefit from them. Everything centers on self. And in this case, self is a very dangerous thing. You can't work it this way. We have to begin to build a proof of life here.